mixed in his nose with the scent of motor oil. He felt the walls for a light for half a minute before bumping into a large object in the middle of the floor. Above it was a cord attached to a light bulb hanging over the middle of the room. Gentry found himself dazzled by the brilliance of the bare bulb. Quickly, he pulled down the garage door to seal himself into the room, turned back to find that the object in the center of the garage was some sort of automobile covered by a large tarp. Maurice had said nothing about loaning him a car. For a second, Court wondered if he'd somehow gained entry into the wrong unit. He pulled back the tarp and let it fall to the pavement. Before him sat a large black sedan, a Mercedes S-Class four-door with a black all-leather interior. Court figured the vehicle must have cost over $100,000.
"Thanks, Maurice," he mumbled.
Opening the unlocked driver's door, the gray man saw the keys were in the ignition. Looking at the dash, he noticed the car had fewer than 4,000 miles on it. She was a beauty, and it would certainly make his 8-hour drive to Normandy quicker and more comfortable, but there were other ways to travel. No, what he really needed were weapons. In Europe, they were far more difficult to come by than efficient means of transportation. With anticipation, he popped the trunk of the Mercedes and walked to the back. Four large aluminum cases stood side by side. Court pulled the first one on top of the others and flipped it open. The corners of his mouth twitched upwards. Heavy metal.
"My hero, Maurice," he said.
An HK MP5, well-oiled and stored in a foam encasement. Four magazines with 30 preloaded 9mm rounds in each lay side by side in the foam, and two fragmentation hand grenades, one resting on either side of the MP5. He loaded the submachine gun, chambered around, and tossed it in the front seat of the Mercedes with all the spare magazines. The second case contained two fragmentation and two flashbang stun grenades, two door-breaching charges, and a small cube of Semtex plastic explosive with a remote detonating device. Court left this equipment in the trunk for now. Brushed aluminum case number 3 housed a handheld GPS unit, two matched walkie-talkies, and a laptop computer. All this gear went into the backseat of the car. In the final case, Court found two Glock 19 9mm pistols and four loaded magazines. Also in this container, Court found a utility belt and two thigh rigs. One was for carrying a Glock on his right hip, and the other would hang from his left leg and hold magazines for the submachine gun and the pistol. On a hunch, he lifted the carpet up in the trunk of the Mercedes. There, he discovered one more weapon, an AR-15 carbine assault rifle. Alongside the spare tire was a plastic container with three loaded magazines full of .223 ammunition, 90 rounds in all. Court spent a few minutes powering up the sat phone and familiarizing himself with the GPS. All the while, the police, fire department, and ambulance sirens continued to wail a quarter mile away at Maurice's house. This massive weapons cache told Gentry two things about his former mentor. One, though he was out of the CIA and living in the open, he still had some reason to believe he might need to blast his way out of a sticky situation. And two, from the look of the top-notch automobile and the insane quantity and quality of the gear, it was apparent to Gentry that the rumors about his mentor had been true. He had likely embezzled from the accounts he maintained for the CIA. Maurice had surely known Gentry would come to this conclusion, yet he still offered up his cash to his young protégé. It was the dying man's last wish that Court use the hoard to get away and succeed in his mission, and not to judge him too harshly for it. As Gentry pulled out of the garage, looked straight ahead through the tinted windows, and passed more first responders on their way to the crime scene on Rue de l'Évêché, his emotions were conflicted. Court had never misappropriated a dime in his life. He had never even run up per diem charges when working hits and black bag jobs for mobsters and drug dealers. No, he was a killer, but he was no thief. That Maurice had stolen from the company was disappointing, but in the end, a great bit of those stolen funds Gentry planned to put to use. Court was at once both idealistic and pragmatic. Maurice's thievery was wrong, but, he told himself, he would not judge his old instructor too harshly. Instead, He'd redeem the old man's honor, use every last goddamn bullet and gun to save the three innocents in Normandy, and retrieve the personnel histories of all the assets in the Special Activities Division. Riegel stood behind the tech. Lloyd stood on his left. The young ponytailed man sat at his desk in front of computer monitors, headphones pressed to his ears. From the expression on the young Brit's face, the two men in charge of the operation could tell the news was not good. The tech said, "We have confirmation from our local sources that all of the South Africans are dead. There was a large explosion at the target location. Looks like it may have been a gas leak, no doubt brought on by gunfire or some other use of ordnance. The fire department is still working on the blaze. They don't have a body count just yet. They only confirm there were no survivors. Multiple fatalities." Lloyd said, "Gentry?" The tech shook his head. "He was seen leaving the building minutes before the explosion."
"Seen by?"
"A watcher who lost him in the crowd."
"Come on!" screamed Lloyd. "Do I have to kill him myself?"
Riegel pulled his phone from his pocket and made a call. Waited a moment.
"Yes, it's me. I need a helicopter. Pick up the following items and get here before dark. Write all this down. Thermal imaging units, motion detectors, remote sensors, monitors, and cabling. You have all that? Also, find Serge and Elaine and get them on that helicopter. Tell them to grab anything else they need to put a 360-degree electronic wall around Chateau Laurent."
Riegel hung up. Lloyd stared at him.
"What was all that about?"
"Electronic surveillance gear. Men to install and monitor it."
"What's it for?"
"It's for Gentry. It's for tonight."
"There are still 300 miles and 35 shooters between him and here. You don't seriously think he's going to make it through to the chateau, do you?"
"It's my responsibility to ensure he dies. Whether he dies in Geneva, on a road in the French Alps, or out here on the lawn, it is my job to salvage your operation. I'm going to use every instrument, every technical advantage, every warm body, and every gun I can put between his current location and his destination."
The tech looked up to the two men behind him. For the first time, the young Englishman showed emotion. Fear.
"Nobody said anything about him actually coming here. I'm not a field man, for Christ's sake."
Riegel looked down at him sternly.
"Consider yourself promoted."
The tech turned back to his terminal. Next, Riegel called up to the tower and had the Belarusian sniper join him and Lloyd out in the back garden. The sniper met them by the fountain, his large Dragunov rifle cradled across his chest. Together, they walked slowly past the blood-stained grass, towards the apple orchard that started at the end of the backyard, and continued on for several hundred yards to the high stone wall that ringed the entire property. Riegel and the sniper sniffed the air, then knelt to the grass and put their hands in it. They looked at everything in their environment carefully. Lloyd just looked bored and annoyed. Riegel spoke to the sniper in Russian. Lloyd stared off towards the orchard.
"You understand the rules of engagement?"
"If it moves towards the chateau, shoot it."
"That's right. Simple enough."
Riegel's hiking boots sank in the well-manicured lawn. He sniffed the air again.
"Did you have fog this morning?"
"Yes. Visibility not more than 200 yards. Couldn't see as far as the apple trees until almost 10 a.m.
"Shouldn't be an issue. If he makes it here at all, it will be before sunrise."
The Belarusian just nodded as he scanned the orchard through his scope. Riegel said,
"You should not have shot the father."
The sniper just shrugged as he scanned the near distance.
"If you were on the scene, I would not have. As it was, I did not have leadership. I made the decision to shoot. That is what I do unless told otherwise."
Riegel nodded. He regarded his sniper for a moment.
"I saw the body. The entry wound. Good decision or not, it was a magnificent shot."
The Belarusian lowered his eye from the scope of his Dragunov, but continued his survey of the orchard. He betrayed not a speck of emotion.
"Da, it was."
Lloyd was tired of being ignored. "Look, Riegel, you're wasting time. Even if Gentry does make it here, which he won't, do you really think he's going to come running straight up the middle of the yard?"
"It's a possibility. He will do whatever he considers his best option."
That's insane. He's not going to storm the castle by himself.
I have to prepare as if he will. His options will be limited.
Well then, why don't you line the fucking garden with landmines? Lloyd's sarcasm was delivered with utter derision.
Regal looked at him a long moment.
Would you know where I can get some landmines?
Just then, Lloyd's phone chirped in his pocket.
Yeah. It's the tech here. Gentry is calling on Sir Donald's phone. I can forward the call to you.
Lloyd hit the speakerphone on his unit.
Do it.
Hello, Lloyd. Gentry's voice was tired.
So, you slipped the noose again. I was hoping to be standing over your charred remains sometime this evening.
No. Instead, your rented thugs just killed a 75-year-old American hero.
Right. A terminally ill out-to-pasture spy on the take. Excuse me while I dab the tears from my eyes.
Fuck you, Lloyd.
You're in Geneva?
You know that I am.
Do you need me to fax you a goddamn map? Northern France is in northern fucking France, not southern Switzerland. I don't know why you went to see Maurice. Money, documentation, weapons, another gunman, whatever.
None of that shit is going to make a damn bit of difference in the long run.
The only thing you need to be worried about right now is time. Because tomorrow morning, when the little hand reaches the 8 and the big hand reaches the 12, it is open fucking season on little British girlies up here.
Don't worry, Lloyd. I'll be there soon.
Why are you calling?
I was sitting here worrying that you may begin to relax. You may think that I died in the explosion. The possibility that you might be having a comfortable afternoon was really beginning to chap my ass. So I thought I'd give you a ring, let you know to leave a light on for me tonight.
Lloyd sniffed into the phone.
You just wanted to make sure I didn't give the mission up for lost. Didn't go downstairs and kill the Fitzroys because I don't need them anymore.
That too. I don't know how many more hit teams you have between you and me, but all the goons on Earth won't stop me from getting my hand around your throat in just a few hours.
The tech ran up to the three men in the back garden. Out of breath, he held up a sheet of paper on which he'd hurriedly scrawled the words, sat phone, no trace. Lloyd frowned. He said,
Court, your death is an inevitability. Why don't you save us all some time, make things easier on everyone, and kill yourself, then put your head in a cooler and ship it up to me?
I'll make you a deal. I'll supply the head. You get the ice chest ready. Soon enough, I'll give you the opportunity to put the two together.
Sounds like a plan, buddy.
Come tomorrow morning, Julius Abu Bakr is going to have to find himself a new bitch to bargain with, because when you fail, and you will fail, either I will kill you, or someone else will.
Lloyd's face twitched in anger.
I'm nobody's bitch, you knuckle-dragging bastard. I've seen a lot of smug scalp hunters come and go in my days. You're no different. You do well to remember that even with your reputation and your spooky nickname, you are just a glorified door-kicker. You'll be dead in a few hours, and I'll have forgotten about you before the maggots finish you off.
There was a short pause. Let me guess, Lloyd. Your dad was somebody.
As a matter of fact, my father is somebody.
Figures. See you soon.
Gentry hung up the phone. Regal hid his smile from Lloyd. The tech stood with his hands on his knees, breathless from the run. He said,
Gentry sounds like he really thinks he'll make it here.
There was palpable terror in his voice between his gasps for air. Lloyd snapped at him.
Get back to work. I want helicopters in the air. I want men on the trains. And I want him dead before he gets to Paris.
An hour later, Regal stood on a flat rampart lining the rear of the chateau's roof. He looked out through the decorative battlements at the cold but sunny afternoon. Three teams of Belarusians, each consisting of two men with assault rifles and radios, walked the grounds in a crisscrossing pattern. The sniper and his spotter were on Regal's left, high in the tower with a near-perfect 360-degree view of the lawn in the back and the lawn in the front. The helicopter with the thermal imaging equipment had just radioed in that they were on their way back from Paris with all the gear and the two-man team of engineers that could set it up in under an hour. The tech had put a hit team on the TGV from Geneva, the high-speed train to Paris. They'd reported no sign of Gentry. Three more teams and most of the available watchers were taking up positions on the highways through the French Alps that the gray man would have to traverse if he was traveling by car or motorcycle. Three more kill squads were in Paris. It was a natural staging area, a city full of his known associates and a city in which he might well stop for supplies or support. There was not much left for Kurt Riegel to do at the moment, but wait. Still, something was bothering him. It started out as a nagging irritation in the back of his mind and grew by the minute as he reconciled himself to the fact that he'd tidied up all the ends of the operation that he could at the moment, but it somehow remained after he could think of no other preparations to make. Finally, he closed in on the origin of his ill ease, something the gray man had said to Lloyd. Sure, Gentry would have figured out this op against him had to do with his assassination of Isaac Abubakar. But what did he mean by Lloyd being Abubakar's bitch? How could Gentry have known that Lloyd wasn't just an employee of Abubakar, or of the CIA doing a job? That he did his job for some other reason. Some sort of bargain. Riegel had read the text handwritten transcripts of Gentry's phone conversation with Lloyd earlier in the day, before Riegel was on site. There was no mention by Lloyd or Fitzroy of Lorne Group, or the true reasons behind this endeavor. Why on earth would the gray man assume this operation involved some sort of deal between the parties, which clearly the term bargain implied? Why on earth would the gray man assume Lloyd's life hung in the balance of his success? It was another full minute of speculation, and when the answer came to Riegel, the sign came to him like it would were he hunting prey on a safari. When tracking an animal, a skilled hunter can find indications in the animal's tracks, indications that it knows it's being pursued. It had picked up a scent. It had seen movement. The gait changes when prey senses trouble, and only a uniquely adept hunter can pick up this subtle alteration in his quarry's tracks. Kurt Riegel was such a hunter. Gentry had more than a scent of the real operation against him. He had specific details that he only could have gotten one way. Kurt Riegel spun on the rampart and entered the chateau. He passed Lloyd, who was stepping out of the bathroom, continued down the corridor with the bearing of a stormtrooper. Lloyd saw the hunter's determination. "What is it? What's wrong?" Riegel said nothing. He marched down the hall and descended the wide, carpeted staircase to the second floor. He stormed down this hallway, past the sconces and the paintings, past the door to Elise Fitzroy's room, past the bedroom where the kids were locked up. With Lloyd close on his heels, he passed Leary, one of the Northern Irish thugs Lloyd had brought along from Lorne Group London. The 52-year-old German threw his shoulder into the heavy door Leary was guarding, and it flew open. In the large room beyond, lying on his back in the bed, covered in white linen and facing the door, Sir Donald Fitzroy stared back at the procession of men filing into the room. Riegel stomped across the room to Sir Donald's bed. He showed none of the courtesy he had displayed in their earlier meeting. His face was that of a man who'd been played for a fool and was out for blood in recompense. In a hushed voice that was incongruous to his mannerisms, Riegel asked a one-word question.
"Where?"
Lloyd and Leary stood back in the center of the room. They looked at one another, searching for some clue as to what was happening.
"What are you talking about?" asked Donald.
Riegel drew his Steyr pistol, pressed it hard to the bald forehead of Sir Donald.
"Your very last chance."
His voice was still a whisper.
"Where is it?"
After a brief pause, Sir Donald Fitzroy's arm moved slowly under the covers. Soon, a mobile phone appeared. He handed it to the big German. Riegel did not even look at it. He slipped it into his pocket.
"Who?"
he asked now, still in a hushed and angry voice. Sir Donald said nothing.
"It will take me seconds to determine the owner of this phone. You can save yourself some measure of misery by giving me the answer yourself."
Sir Donald looked away from Riegel, across the room to Lloyd. Then his eyes drifted to the Northern Irish guard.
"Patrick Leary worked for me back in the old days, back in Belfast. You were one of my best touts, Paddy."
He looked back to Kurt Riegel.
"Still the wanker shook me down for a king's ransom to make a couple of lousy calls."
As Regal's fury turned from the Englishman to the Irishman, Fitzroy called out to the stupefied guard.
"Sorry, old boy. Don't guess I can come through with the 10,000 quid after all. You'll just have to take solace in the fact you remain a loyal servant to a nobleman of the crown."
Leary looked back to Regal.
"A bloody lie! That's a right bleeding Brit for you. He's bloody lying! Before 2 days ago, I never laid eyes on the fucking old bastard!"
"Is this your phone?"
Regal pulled it from his pocket and held it out. Leary looked at it for several seconds, then began walking towards Fitzroy in his bed.
"How the fuck did you get your wrinkled old hands on my—"
A gunshot cracked in the small room. Leary's head snapped forward, and he crashed face first at Regal's feet. The German dropped to a knee in a blur of action, raised his weapon in a flash as he went down. Lloyd stood in the middle of the room, his arm outstretched, and a small silver automatic at the end of it. It was still pointed out to where the back of the Irishman's head was before the .380 hollow-point round sent it lurching forward.
"Nein!"
shouted Regal in a Germanic scream. As Lloyd spoke, he waved the gun around the room, used it as a pointer, swung it with his gesticulations. "We have enough problems out there without having to worry about enemies in our midst." He then motioned to Regal, who was still in a low crouch, eyes on the handgun dancing about the room at the end of Lloyd's arm. "You wanted to treat Donnyboy like a gentleman, and this is how he repays you. You were too soft, and he used that against you. He's been manipulating people since before I was born. That's what he does. Find out who he called and what he said. You do it right now, or I will call Mark Laurent and tell him you are getting in the way of my mission." Lloyd lowered the gun and turned. He left the room. After a few more seconds on his knee with his gun raised, still scanning for targets, Regal holstered his weapon, looked back to Fitzroy, and said,
"I'm disappointed."
Fitzroy's voice was surprisingly strong.
"I see the desperation, Regal. I see it in your eyes as well as Lloyd's. This is not only about a contract to siphon and ship natural gas. Abu Bakr has something else he's holding over Laurent Group. Some dirt about your past, your practices. Something that, should it see the bright light of day, would blow your organization to pieces."
Regal looked in a mirror hanging above a large armoire. He fixed his graying blonde hair with his fingertips.
"Yes, Sir Donald. We've allowed ourselves to be caught up in quite an unbelievable predicament. My father used to say, if you lie down with dogs, you will wake up with fleas. Well, we have lain down with many, many a dog for many, many years. Abu Bakr is one of the worst, and he knows much about what Mark Laurent will do for money and power. Since the decolonization of Africa, the continent's resources have been ripe for exploitation for anyone prepared to dance with a despot. We have had Abu Bakr in our back pocket for years, and now we are on his. He's threatening to talk about the length to which Mark Laurent has gone to take resources from Africa. It's not a pretty story. We'd very much prefer the outgoing president held his tongue."
With that, Regal started to the door. Without a backward glance, he called out to his prisoner,
"I'll send someone to clean up the body." "Don't bother. When court gets here, there will be corpses all over the house."
Chapter 26. 5 soldiers of Saudi Arabia's Al-Mukhabarat Al-Amma, or General Intelligence Directorate, flew west over the Alps in a stolen Eurocopter EC-145. The chopper was the property of a local owner-operator who'd made a good living ferrying snowboarders and extreme skiers to otherwise inaccessible peaks on Mount Blanc and other mountains in the area. Now the sleek black Eurocopter's owner, a former French army major, was dead in his hangar, shot once through the heart with a silenced pistol, and the Saudis flew his craft north over the highway. The road below them rose and fell, weaved and disappeared into alpine tunnels, and rushed past bright green forests and lakes so blue, the bright sky around them looked positively dull in comparison. Only the Saudi pilot spoke English. He stayed in sporadic contact with the tech, an open two-way communication between his headset and the command center that came and went with the jagged peaks on either side of the aircraft. The tech simultaneously ran other hit teams in the area and relayed reports from one of the watchers at bus stations and taxi stands. No sign of the gray man had been reported since he slipped his coverage just after leaving the financier's home in Geneva. The A40 is the obvious highway for a traveler to take from Geneva, Switzerland, through southwestern France, into the French heartland. There, at the city of Viriat, one could stay on the A40 to the A6, or one could go northeast on the A39 into Dijon. Either way, it is roughly a 5-hour drive to Paris, as compared with 6 or more hours by avoiding these routes. The Saudis in the helicopter knew where to look for their target. If he came over the roads, they knew he would pass below them on the A40. They just did not know what type of vehicle they were looking for. 30 watchers positioned themselves at overpasses, rest stops, along the highway shoulders, with the hoods up on their vehicles. Others drove along with the traffic. Each pavement artist watched the road, scanned the occupants of as many cars as possible for the most basic profile. It was a large operation to remain concealed to the police, and for that reason and others, Riegel had been against the enterprise entirely. When it became clear Gentry had not boarded a train or taken a bus, Riegel wanted all watchers, all kill teams, and all resources to be pulled back to Paris. He was certain the gray man would not bypass Paris altogether. Riegel presumed, and Lloyd did not dispute, that the CIA financier court met in Geneva had probably supplied him with some equipment, weaponry, a vehicle, medical attention, and likely cash. Also, Riegel supposed that if the gray man had time to field a call from Sir Donald Fitzroy, then he had time to get other contacts from the well-connected ex-CIA banker. If court had made arrangements to pick up men or materiel, he would have no time to go anywhere other than the locations already on the way. Paris was the last major city on his route, and it was chock full of shooters, document forgers, black market gun dealers, former CIA pilots, and all other manner of ne'er-do-wells the gray man could employ to help him rescue the Fitzroys and take back the personnel files Lloyd stole from American intelligence. Riegel wanted all the operations resources to concentrate on Paris, but Lloyd demanded one final choke point ambush set up on the main highway to the north to stop Gentry before he made it any closer to the chateau. But Gentry did not take the A40 to the A6, nor did he take the A40 to the A39. These were by far the most efficient routes, but, court reasoned, they were only efficient to those travelers not targeted for termination by dozens of killers along these roads. No. Court decided the operation against him warranted his adding an extra 2 or so hours driving time on his tired and hurting body. It would suck, 7 full hours behind the wheel just to make it to Paris, but he saw no alternative. Buses and trains were out of the question with all the gear in the trunk he had to transport. He had to drive. At least he was driving in style. The Mercedes S550 was sleek and solid, and the nearly new interior filled his nostrils with the luxurious scent of fine leather. The 382-horsepower engine purred at 85 miles an hour, and the satellite sound system kept Court company. From time to time, Gentry put on local radio, struggled with the French to pick up tidbits of information about gun battles in Budapest, Guarda, and Lausanne, and something about a house explosion in the old town section of Geneva. By 5 in the afternoon, Gentry's exhaustion threatened to run him off the road. He pulled into a rest stop just shy of the town of Saint-Dizier. He filled his tank and bought a ubiquitous French ham and cheese sandwich in a large baguette. He downed 2 sodas and bought a huge bottle of water after a bathroom visit. In 15 minutes, he was back on the road. His GPS, resting on his dashboard, told him he would not make it into Paris until 9 p.m. Calculating all he needed to do before heading on to Normandy, Gentry determined he'd arrive at the chateau about 2:30 in the morning. That was, he admitted to himself, only if he did not have any problems in Paris.
"It's time to pull everyone back to the capital," said Riegel.
He stood behind Lloyd and the tech, having just returned to the command center after working for 2 hours with the French security engineers on the electronic cordon around the chateau. Lloyd just nodded, repeated the German's words to the tech sitting next to him. He then turned back to the VP of Security Risk Management Operations.
"Where the hell is he?"
"We knew there was the possibility he would take another route. There are 100 ways he could have gone.
A drive through the countryside will delay his arrival to Paris, but it will still get him there.
If he goes to Paris.
We assume he is not going to attack a defended fortress full of gunmen and hostages by himself. He's going to have to get some help before he comes here, and he has more known associates in Paris than anywhere else. If he stops at all, he stops in Paris. We have all the associates covered. Plus, since he's injured, I've got men at all the hospitals in Paris to keep watch.
He won't go to a hospital.
I agree. Probably not. He won't expose himself like that.
A doctor in Fitzroy's network, perhaps?
Possibly. But the pavement artists are all over the place, staked out at every known contact.
I don't want him getting out of Paris alive.
I gathered as much, Lloyd.
Chapter 27 Gentry hit the eastern edge of Paris just after 9 o'clock on Saturday night. His pains in his feet and knees and thigh and wrist and ribs were only exceeded by his overwhelming fatigue. But still, he pushed into town, found an overpriced parking space in an underground garage next to the Gare Saint-Lazare train station. He put all the guns in the back seat, locked the vehicle, and headed up to street level. He'd had plenty of time to work out his Paris plan of action on the drive, and had used the GPS to find a couple of shops in the area. After a few minutes on foot through the cold and misty evening, he hit a McDonald's, pushed through the crowd of kids of all nationalities, and made his way to the bathroom. Here, he spent a minute and a half washing his tired face, slicking back his messy hair, using the bathroom, and wiping his clothing with a small gel air freshener. It was a feeble attempt to clean up, but it was better than nothing. 5 minutes later, he stepped into a men's store on the Rue de Rome, just as the salesman was turning the sign at the door to Fermé. Court picked up a high-priced off-the-rack pinstripe suit, black, a white shirt, a muted blue tie, a belt, and shoes. He paid for these at the clothing counter, then headed across the street to a sporting goods shop with his suit bag over his shoulder. Here, he bought a full wardrobe of rugged outdoor clothing in subdued browns. He made his way back out into the street just as the last of the late-night clothing shops shut for the evening, found a pharmacy across from the station, and purchased an electric razor and a straight razor, scissors, shaving cream, and a few candy bars. He took a pair of black-framed costume glasses out of a rack and tried them on, decided they would suit his needs. Just as he stepped up to the counter to pay, he spotted a distinguished-looking long black umbrella hanging off a shelf by its hooked handle. The well-made accessory had caught his eye. Fumbling with his new wares and his other bags, he snatched up the umbrella and paid the bored Asian man at the register. Just after 10, Gentry hauled all his loot back to the train station, stayed close to the walls, and kept his head down and away from the security cameras around the long, open hall. He ignored a half-dozen Bosnian women begging for change, and entered an empty bathroom down a hallway from a platform that had accommodated its last train of the evening. He stowed all his bags in a stall and went to work. Quickly, he stripped to his undershirt and cut his hair. He tried to get as much in the toilet as possible, but also laid plastic bags from his clothing purchases on the floor to catch the rest. Next, he used the electric razor to shave his head down to the absolute stubble. The straight razor and cream finished the job. He popped out of the stall twice to check his work in the mirror, but retreated back to privacy quickly to avoid arousing suspicion should someone walk in. When he finished, he carefully pushed the bags of clippings into the waste bin and then flushed the toilet of hair. With his head cleanly shaved, he washed it again in the sink, quickly put on the suit and the shirt and the tie and the shoes. He slipped on his costume glasses, hefted his distinguished-looking umbrella, and collected the rest of his bags. 18 minutes after Gentry walked into the bathroom, a different man walked out. The hair and clothing had changed, of course, but also his gait was longer, his posture more erect. Court fought against his desire to limp off his right leg. The suited gentleman descended the stairs back to the parking garage and deposited his bags, retrieved one of the Glock pistols, then returned to the street, just a well-dressed Parisian strolling alone on his way home from a nice restaurant, his umbrella swinging along beside him as he moved with the pedestrians in the November mist.
He climbed into a cab on the Rue Saint-Lazare at 11:30 and instructed the driver in halting French
to take him to the Saint-Germain-des-Prés neighborhood of the left bank. Song Park Kim had spotted the Kazakhs by the Notre Dame Cathedral. He had no doubt they were hunters after the same target as he. From his sharp eye, they could not hide, and the Korean had no doubt the gray man would ID them just as easily. He also passed three or four static surveillance operatives. His training picked them out in the Saturday evening crowds, but he determined them to be adequately skilled nonetheless. Kim knew his target. If the gray man were to make a stop off in Paris at all, he should have arrived by now. His already super-sharp senses prickled a bit more as he listened to each dead-end report from the tech over his earpiece, and the Korean walked from boulevard to boulevard, appearing nonchalant but remaining carefully equidistant to the known associate locations. Kim walked in complete silence on an empty street. A single Irish pub lit the cobblestones ahead of him. Otherwise, it was dark, and the Korean used the night as his confederate, moving quickly and comfortably like a nocturnal hunter. At the corner of Boulevard Saint-Michel and Rue du Sommerard, he ducked down an alley, found a fire escape he'd spotted earlier in his full day of wandering the city, and leapt high to grab hold. The rucksack on his back swung, the HK machine pistol and the extra magazines causing the olive-green bag to hang down as the Korean assassin pulled himself up the rungs. He climbed onto the metal staircase without a sound and scaled up to the sixth floor. Another heave with his strong arms, and he was over the top and on the roof. From here, he could see the Eiffel Tower more than a mile away in front of him. The Seine was on his right, and the Latin Quarter all around him, stretching off to his left. The rooftops continued along the Boulevard Saint-Michel, touched one another, and made a path high above the streets below. This would be Kim's starting point for the evening. If gentry ventured anywhere on the left bank, Kim could move quickly and quietly over this row of buildings or others like it. If the gray man showed on the right bank, Kim could be there within minutes by dropping down and running across any one of the bridges a few blocks to the north that span the cold, swift river, its surface shimmering as it flowed through the city of lights. Court Gentry climbed out of his taxi at an internet café on the Boulevard Saint-Germain.
He ordered an hour's web time and a double espresso from the bar, paid, and then politely nudged his way through the throngs of students toward an open computer at the back. His glasses low on his nose, his cup and saucer in his hands, his fancy umbrella hooked over his arm. Once online, he opened a search engine and typed in Laurent Group Properties in France. He clicked on a website that showed off the real estate holdings of the huge firm, ports, offices, truck farms, and a web page for corporate retreats. Here he found Chateau Laurent, a family property used by the corporation northeast of the tiny village of Maisons in Lower Normandy. Once he had the name, he searched the web for more information about the property, found a site showing private chateaus of Europe, looked over the glamour shots of the squat 17th-century manor house. He committed many of the facts to memory, ignored others that didn't seem so important, like the fact that Mitterrand had shot rabbits on the grounds or that some of Rommel's senior officers had billeted their wives there when in town to make final preparations to the Atlantic Wall. He wrote the address down with a pen borrowed from a dark-skinned boy sitting next to him. Then he surfed to Laurent Group's corporate website. It took him a few minutes to find the address in its corporate holdings. The chateau was listed just as a satellite office and not a company retreat. But from here, Court found the listed phone number to the building. He wrote this on his forearm while the young kid who loaned him the pen laughed and offered him a sheet of paper, which Gentry declined. Next, the American took a few minutes to look at a satellite map of the area around the castle. The layout of the forest, streams running nearby, the orchards behind the 300-year-old stone building, and the graveled country roads outside the encircling wall. He took one more look at the shots of the structure. A large turret was the high point of the building. Court knew a marksman would lurk there. He also knew there were 200 yards of open ground between Chateau Laurent and the apple orchard in the back. There was a shorter distance in front of the building, but a higher stone wall and better lighting. He imagined there would be patrolling men with dogs, watchers in the village, and maybe even a helicopter in the air. Lloyd clearly had the resources at his disposal to protect a mansion from one lousy, limping attacker. The fortification was not impenetrable. Few places were impenetrable to gentry. But if he left Paris right this very minute, he would not get to Bayeux before 2 in the morning. He had until 8 to rescue the Fitzroys before Lloyd's deadline, but this was false comfort. He knew if he was to have any chance for success, he'd have to make his move in the dead of night when the guard force would be groggy and reaction times would suffer. So, even though there were surely ways to breach Chateau Laurent, it would be tough to breach without laying up for hours and hours to get a feel for the security measures. He would not have hours and hours. A couple hours watch at most before daylight. And again, that was only if he left Paris right now. And that was not his plan. At 1 a.m., Gentry sat in the Café Le Luxembourg and drank his second double espresso of the evening, among the young and the beautiful on the Rue Soufflot. A small ham sandwich sat untouched on a plate in front of him. The coffee was bitter, but he knew the caffeine would help him through the next few hours. That and good hydration. So he chugged his second 5-euro bottle of mineral water while he pretended to read a day-old copy of Le Monde. His eyes darted around, but they kept returning to a building across the street, number 23. Really, Court just wanted to get up and go, get out of town without pursuing his objective in Paris. He knew he would be taking a tremendous risk to pay a visit to the man in the apartment building across the little street, but he needed help, not just for himself, but also a way to get the Fitzroys clear. The man across the street was named Van Zan. He was Dutch, a former CIA-contracted ferryman and an awesome pilot of small prop planes. Court had planned to pay him a surprise visit, wave some cash under his nose, grossly underplay the danger in making a 5 a.m. trip up to Bayeux to pick up a family of 4 and Court himself, and then fly them low over the channel to the U.K. Van Zan was a known associate, so Lloyd would have had his phone tapped within minutes of beginning this operation and would have planted surveillance outside his door. Court knew he couldn't call Van Zan, but he figured he could duck past a watcher or two and drop in for a personal visit. Yeah, it was a good plan, Court told himself, as he gulped bitter espresso and pointed his unfocused eyes at the newspaper in front of his face. But slowly he realized it wasn't going to happen.
Sure, Court knew he could slip a couple of surveillance goons and make it in to see Van Zan.
A couple, yes, but not a half dozen. While sipping his espresso, he'd compromised 5 definite watchers, and there was another person in the crowd who did not belong.
Shit, thought Court.
Not only did he now know there was no way he could get into Van Zan's place to make him an offer, but he was beginning to feel extremely hemmed in and vulnerable, surrounded by a half dozen eagle eyes. There were 2, a young couple hanging out in the Quality Burger across the street. They checked out each white male passerby, then jacked their heads back towards the doorway to the alcove to Van Zan's place. Then there was the man alone in his parked car. He was Middle Eastern, strummed his fingers on the dash like he was listening to music, watched the crowd as they passed. Number 4 stood at the bus stop in front of the Luxembourg Gardens, like he was waiting for a bus, but he never even glanced at the front of any of the buses that pulled up to see where they were going. 5 stood on a second-floor balcony, held a camera with a lens the size of a baguette, and pretended to take photos of the vibrant intersection, but Court wasn't buying it for a second. His shots were up and down the pavement below him and across the street at the alcove. Nothing of the well-lit Pantheon up the road to his left. Nothing of the typically French produce stands and the beautiful iron fencing around the Luxembourg Gardens. At number 6 was a woman, alone, in the café, just a few tables ahead of Gentry. He'd made sure to get a table towards the back, but near the window that ran along the side of the eatery. From here, he could keep an eye on everyone in the room with him while covering his face with the paper, and yet still look to his right to Van Zan's place and those around it. She had done the same thing, sitting just ahead. Number 6 was slick. She spent 80% of her time looking down to her big foamy mocha, not bouncing every glance out the window. But her mistake was her dress and her attitude. She was French. He could tell by her clothes and countenance. But she was alone and did not seem to know anyone in the café. A pretty French girl in her 20s who spent Saturday night alone, away from friends but still out in the crowd, in a café unfamiliar to her, in a part of town she did not know. No, Court determined, she was a pavement artist, a watcher, a follower, paid to sit there and keep her big doughy eyes peeled. After eating his little sandwich and finishing his coffee, after giving up on his great plan to set up a foolproof escape route after saving the Fitzroys, he decided he needed to get away, get out of town, get up to Bayou and work something out. His spirits had ebbed to their lowest point since yesterday morning. He was even more dejected than he'd been when sitting in the moldy pit in Laszlo's laboratory. But Gentry knew the absolute worst thing he could do right now was sit and sulk. He dropped a wad of euro notes on his table and slipped down a back hall to the bathroom. After relieving himself, he continued down the hall, ducked into the kitchen like he belonged, walked straight to a back door and then through it onto the Rue Monsieur le Prince. No one in the kitchen looked up at the man in the black suit. The gray man had that ability. 5 minutes later, Regal stood again on the walkway on the roof and stared through the crenellations at the moonlit gardens. The scent of the apple orchard in the distance mixed with the cold darkness. Regal hoped to clear his head a bit, to get away from Lloyd and the tech and the Belarusians and the incessant radio reports from the watchers in Paris who had yet to see anyone and the kill squads who had yet to kill anyone. His phone chirped in his pocket. His first inclination was to ignore the call. It was probably one of the Foreign Intelligence Service chieftains wondering why their team hadn't checked in and how the fuck they could have all been wiped out working on a commercial job. Regal knew he'd spend months or years smoothing over this catastrophe, and that was only if the Lagos contract did get signed by 8 a.m. If not, and Regal did not want to even think of this, but if not, he'd likely lose his job, or at least his position. Laurent had too much riding on this not to put every possible pressure to bear. Regal felt like his head was on the chopping block, much like Lloyd's. Not literally like Lloyd. Regal was certain Laurent would eventually order Regal to have Lloyd killed if the operation failed. Regal would not die for this fiasco like the young American, but still, his career would be ruined if his corporation's excesses in Africa were brought to light by that shameless son of a bitch, Julius Ebubaker. The phone rang again. With a sigh that blew vapor into the night, he pulled the phone from his pocket.
Regal.
Sir, it's the tech. There's a call for you on the landline. I can send it to your mobile.
The landline? You mean the Chateau's phone?
Yes, sir. Wouldn't say who he was. He's speaking English.
Thank you.
A click. Regal asked.
Who is speaking, please?
I am the guy you just can't quite seem to kill. A chill ran up Kurt Regal's spine. He did not know Fitzroy had given his name to the gray man. After a moment to collect himself, he said,
Mr. Gentry, it is an honor to speak with you. I have followed your career and consider you a very formidable adversary.
Flattery will get you nowhere.
I've been looking over your file.
Interesting?
Very.
Well, read up, Kurt, because I intend to pull my file out of your cold, dead hands. Kurt Regal chuckled aloud.
What can I do for you?
I just wanted to make a social call.
I have hunted all manner of quarry in my life, big and small, including quite a few humans. This is the first time I have had a social conversation with my prey shortly before the kill.
Same here. There was a short pause. Then Regal laughed. His laughter carried across the dark expanse of the chateau's rear garden.
Oh, I am your prey now.
You know I am coming for you.
You won't make it. And if you somehow do make it to Normandy, you certainly won't make it to me.
We'll see.
We know you are in Paris.
Paris? What are you talking about? I'm standing right behind you.
You are a funny man. That surprises me.
Regal said it with a chuckle, but he could not help himself from looking back over his shoulder and at the empty walkway around the chateau's roof.
We have all your known associates covered with literally dozens of watchers.
Really? I wouldn't know.
Yes. You must be going from one old friend to the next. You are identifying my surveillance teams because you are good, but you are not good enough to become invisible. So, you must turn away from your potential source of aid. Water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink.
Proud of yourself, aren't you?
As soon as we see you, we will swoop down. I have nearly as many guns in Paris as I do sets of eyes.
Lucky for me, I'm not in Paris. Regal paused. When he spoke again, his tone had changed.
I want you to know, Philip Fitzroy's death was a regrettable accident. I was away at the time. It should not have happened.
Don't bother to try to charm me with professionalism. That won't save you when I come. You and Lloyd are both dead men.
So you continue to say. You should know I recovered the telephone Sir Donald took from the guard. Your intelligence source from inside the chateau has been eliminated.
Court said nothing.
It's looking bleak for your side, my friend.
It is. Maybe I'll just walk away. Give up. Regal considered this.
I don't think so. When you went south to Geneva, I thought perhaps you were leaving the chase. But no. You are a hunter, as am I. It is in your blood, isn't it? You can't turn away. You have your quarry, your objective, your raison d'être. Without men like Lloyd and me to target, you would be a sorry soul indeed. You will not walk off into the morning. You will come for us, and you will die along the way. You must know this, but you would rather be killed by your prey than give up the hunt.
Perhaps we can make an alternate arrangement. Regal smiled.
Ah, now we come to the reason for your call. Not just being social, then. I am listening with interest, Mr. Gentry.
You will lose the contract. When I am still alive in 7 hours, Abu Bakr will give your natural gas deal to your competitor, and he will use whatever it is he has on Laurent Group against you. You cannot avoid that. But if you let the girls and their mother go, just get them to a safe place when I come tomorrow, after the deadline. I will kill Lloyd, do your job for you. But I will spare you.
Spare me?
You have my word.
In my mind's eye, I always pictured you as a two-dimensional predator, a gunman, nothing more. But you are actually a clever fellow, aren't you? You and I could be friends under other circumstances.
Are you flirting with me?
You make me smile, Gentry. But you will make me smile even more when I am standing over your body. Another trophy for my case.
You really should consider my offer.
You overestimate your negotiating leverage, sir. We will have you within the hour.
A pause. You'd better hope so. Sleep well, Mr. Regal.
I might stay up a while. I am expecting some good news from my associates in Paris. Bonsoir, Court.
A bientôt, Kurt. See you soon.
Just one more thing, Mr. Gentry. Call it professional curiosity on my part. Kiev. Not you, was it?
The line went dead, and Regal shook in the cold that seemed to have just blown down from the coast, 4 kilometers to the north.
Chapter 28. The watcher was bored, but he was accustomed to boredom. He'd spent 12 hours on the same street corner, sipped espressos in 3 different cafes, the first 2 at tables outside in the bright morning and the graying and chilly afternoon, and then, lastly, inside at a window table as the air filled with vapor and the last of the day's warmth left the street and sidewalk. At 9 he'd moved to his car, a small Citroën parked at an hourly meter that he'd been feeding all day like a hungry pet. But the watcher was good, and his boredom did not affect his tradecraft. He had the engine running for warmth, but did not play the radio. He knew his ears were nearly as likely to pick up any hint of his quarry as were his eyes.
The radio would rob from his senses the sharpness needed to pick a man he'd never seen out of a passing crowd of thousands. He did not know the larger picture of this mission, only knew his role. He was static surveillance.
Unlike other watchers on this detail, he was not assigned to a known associate location.
Instead, his detail was a general choke point overwatch. He had a photograph of a man, and he was to spend the day trying to match the two-dimensional, years-old, 5x7 picture to a living, breathing, moving target who would likely be trained in surveillance countermeasures and no doubt flow along in a crowd who would obstruct the watcher's view. But the watcher stayed optimistic. There was no other way to work. He knew if he doubted he'd see the man, this would detract him from the acute senses he needed to bring to bear on his little operation. The watcher was no killer, just a well-trained pair of eyes. A long time ago, he'd been a cop in Nice. Then he worked a while in French counterintelligence as a pavement artist, following Russians or whomever around in leapfrogging details of surveillance, the bottom rung of the espionage ladder. More recently, he'd practiced as a private investigator in Lyon. But now he was principally an odd job man for Regal in Paris. There was always a need for the surveillance of someone on the continent, and this watcher was usually one of the team. Though he was older than most of the rest, he was no leader. He was better than the rest when he was sharp, but he was a once and future drunk, could not be relied on long term, though tonight he stayed off the wine and on the mission. The watcher looked back again, for the thousandth time, to the photo in his hand.
It was of no concern to him what the face had done, or what fate awaited the face after he'd been spotted.
The face was not a man, just a target. The face was not alive, did not breathe or think or feel or hurt or need or love. The face was just a target, not a man. Identifying a target in the field brought a bonus from Regal. It did not bring even a shred of regret or guilt to the watcher. Just after 1:30, the watcher pissed into a plastic bottle without missing a drop, also without batting an eyelash at the ignobility of his action among the beautiful people
passing by unawares within feet of him on the Boulevard Saint-Germain.
He screwed the cap on tightly and tossed the warm bottle to the floorboard, and just looked up when a man appeared in the half-light of a street lamp.
He walked along with another group of passers-by,
but he stuck out somehow to the watcher. He was younger than the others, was not coupled as they were, and his suit was slightly incongruous to their less formal attire. The man was 25 meters away when first noticed by the man in the Citroën. As he came closer, the eyeglasses and the shaved head and general facial features sharpened. The watcher did not move a muscle, only glanced down to the photo clenched and moist and wrinkled in his hand, then back up to the three-dimensional figure closing in the evening fog. Maybe. At 15 meters, the watcher squinted, thought he detected a slight limp in the stride. Yes, this man was favoring his right leg. The French-speaking Brit who'd been sending out the updates throughout the day had said the target might have an injury to one thigh. Yes. When the target moved to his closest point to the Citroën, not more than 5 meters away, the watcher saw two things about the man's face that clinched his certainty that his choice of choke point and his 12-hour-long vigil had paid off. There was a wince in the man's cheek with each step, just a touch, when his right foot touched down. That, and his eyes. The watcher was good, was well trained. He saw the darting movement of the younger man's eyes as he strolled. Where his body language portrayed a man sashaying through the left bank without a care in the world, the eyes were a flutter of constant movement. This man was watching out for watchers, and as soon as the pavement artist in the Citroën noticed this, he broke off surveillance, looked down to his hands until the man had fully passed. With a suddenly ferocious heartbeat, he waited several seconds to glance into his rear view, did not turn his head or lift his shoulders or even flex his neck to do so. Just his eyes flitted up and caught the man in the suit as he moved on,
west, on the Boulevard Saint-Germain.
The watcher put his car into gear as he pressed a single button on his earpiece. After a beep indicating his call had been put through, he heard, "Tech, go ahead." The watcher was trained, was good, but he could not hide the excitement in his voice. This, even more than the money earned from the jobs, was what he lived for. He said,
"Dick, this is 63.
A very slight pause.
"I have him. He's moving east on foot."
He needn't say more.